agenda. Mr. Lank, do we have any changes to our vast agenda today?
No changes.
All right then, entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend we approve the agenda circulated.
Second.
It's moved and seconded to approve the agenda as circulated. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, carried. All right, gentlemen, our next order of business is a discussion of sidewalks.
Before we start, for the benefit of the commission, Andrew Dalby, sitting between IG and Mike Johnson, is an intern. He goes to working on his master's in planning and at Temple. And he's been working with us since January? No.
Yeah.
Late last year for informational purposes on projects, sidewalks, subdivisions, churches, you name it. We threw a couple things at him to play around with, and he's been very helpful.
Been helpful on looking at
today.
Looking at how other jurisdictions treat things. So, you know, a lot of times when it's an issue, we figure that we're clearly not the first jurisdiction to deal with something. Andrew's been real helpful in looking at other places to see how they do things to come up with alternatives on things. And we thought it'd be a good idea for him to be here for both the presentations, also to introduce Andrew to you folks since we've mentioned him before. So,
all right then. Well, welcome, young man. We're glad to have you aboard. Do you have any introductory comments you'd like to make?
Nothing pressing.
It's nothing like being put on the spot, is there?
Yeah, it's okay. Welcome. We appreciate your good work, and we'll let our counselor proceed.
Thank you.
I figured I'd come down here. It's easier for me to talk from down here on these types of things. Vince Robertson, law firm of Griffin & Hackett, 3315.
Good.
What we wanted to talk about, it's come up over time, as you all know, with the commission, is sidewalks. And it's really a two-part issue that we need to deal with. One is we really should come up with some uniformity in how we deal with them. I mean, they've been dealt with on an ad hoc basis, either because they've been acquired or because the developer has proffered them, you know, at the preliminary hearing stage. And there's been one side of the street, no side of the street, no sidewalks, and then requests to have sidewalks either reduced or eliminated. It's just been dealt with on a case-by-case basis, which it seems like, I think, as you've heard, like Mr. Fuqua say, if you just tell us what the rules are, we'll all be a lot better off figuring out how we got to meet them. So that's the first issue of it. The second is more of an internal thing. It's whether sidewalks are an amenity or a public works issue. And to you all, that may seem like, you know, an exercise in semantics, but if it's an amenity, the bonding and some other things and inspections are done through Lawrence's office. And if it's public works, it's done through the public works department with Mike Brady and those folks out at the West Complex. My personal thought would be that if we come up with uniformity, then it's a public works issue. It's part of the road cross sections and things of that nature. So, you know, that's where we are on that. Just a little bit of background. The only place now that the code requires sidewalks or talks about them really is in cluster subdivision. If you go the expedited route and provide your superiority information, then you got to have sidewalks on one side of a street. Since everybody's expedited right now, you know, that really doesn't make such a difference.
Kind of lost its luster.
Yeah. Couple things that you've heard me talk about to consider with sidewalks, just based on my experience dealing with homeowners associations as much as the county, is one, the cost going in on a project. You know, there's a significant cost to putting sidewalks in all the way around every street in a subdivision. You know, and so whether it's appropriate in some, it may not be appropriate in others as far as cost. Equally important, if not more so, may be the cost to maintain them by the homeowners association 10 to 15 years down the road. You know, it's one thing to say that a developer has to put them in, but we also need to look at the end result. You know, there's going to be homeowners that at some point are going to need to have to replace these things, which is a significant hit on a homeowners association with special assessments and things. And then one of them that's more, you know, sort of less quantitative, I guess, is just the need. One thing we hear time and time again at the commission is, you know, in rural subdivisions particularly, people prefer to use the streets or just frankly just use the streets if they're going to go for a walk, and so is a sidewalk redundant at that point? So those are just some things I'd like you all to think about. I went through Kent County and Newcastle County just to see how they handle them. And in Newcastle County, they just say you got to have them on both sides of every street unless the lots are greater than 1 acre in size. I mean, so it's just, you know, across the board, this is what you got to do. You know, keep in mind also Newcastle County's a lot more urban than Sussex County is. So, you know, because of that suburban-urban sort of nature, that probably makes more sense than most of the subdivisions we have in Sussex County. But it's a quantitative issue. You're bigger than an acre, you got to have something, the sidewalks. Kent County, they do it if it's less than 3 units an acre density, just both sides of the streets on the residential collector roads. So that would be probably, and they define that, but you know, the entrance roads are the main thoroughfares in the subdivision. If it's greater than 3 units an acre, it's both sides on all streets. So, you know, they do it by density, basically. You know, kind of trying to figure out different categories that we could look at. And I'm not suggesting that we come up with exact details, but maybe if, you know, there's a consensus on what maybe would work best, me and Lawrence and Andrew, you know, can start putting together maybe some draft ordinances in terms of putting the ideas to paper. One would be just based on the sheer size of a subdivision. If you start with a parcel that's more than, you know, 50 acres, and we don't need to decide the acreage now, but if it's more than a certain acreage, you got to have subdivision, or you got to have sidewalks on, you know, one side of the street or both sides of the street. Another sort of factor would be location, you know, and I sort of broke it down to developing versus non-developing. You know, that's the way our comp plan works, you know, meaning the developing areas, those are sort of more the towards the town center areas where there's a lot more going on than a non-developing or more rural area. One across the board way to do it would be just strictly by zoning. You know, if you say, all right, every subdivision in an MR or GR, for example, it's got to have subdivision, or excuse me, it has to have sidewalks on one side of the street or both sides of the street. And then anything in an AR, with the exception of the cluster requirements we talked about, doesn't need them or only needs them on one side. You know, so if you just do it by zoning district, you kind of make it easily dealt with. If you're in GR, this is what you got to have. If you're in AR, this is what you got to have. If you're in MR, this is what you got to have. Kind of a little bit like the density thing in Kent County, you could do it by lot sizes. You know, if it's a three-quarter acre subdivision, you know, those are the bigger rural ones, maybe you don't need sidewalks. If you're in a environmentally sensitive or cluster subdivision where it's 7,500 square foot lots, you know, maybe it makes more sense because you've got, you know, everybody, you know, sort of crammed into a smaller area. I shouldn't say crammed, I should say designed into a smaller area. You know, and then the other one, kind of going along with the first one about the size of the subdivision, maybe a simple way to do it is just you draw a line in the sand, any subdivision over 50 lots, regardless of the size of the lots, they've got to have subdivision sidewalks on one side of the street. And maybe if, like, anything over 50 has got to have one side, anything over 75 or 100 has got to have two sides. I'm not saying those numbers or whatever, but that's just a way to break it down. So I don't know if you all have given any thought to how to handle it, but those are some different sort of categories, you know, that we've come up with and talked with over the years. You know, and I'd like to hear feedback from the commission on, you know, sort of what you think's the most workable possible ways of dealing with it. We can come up with ordinances that address, you know, all five of those different means of dealing with this and just leave blanks for, you know, either the number of lots or the zoning or the, you know, whatever. But if there's one kind of path you think works best, you know, that might be sort of a start.
Need to look at RPCs too, which typically an RPC's got a high density, so they would probably be automatic.
Yeah.
Either one side or both sides, that would be what you'd really be deciding.
I kind of left them out for now just to deal with the subdivisions.
They refer to it in subdivision ordinance anyway.
Anyone?
Hey, gentlemen. Anybody have an opinion?
Well, Mr. Robertson, if you could, backing up after you initially said sidewalks, and you at your beginning said they're dealt with on a case-by-case basis, and then sometimes we are trying to answer the question, are sidewalks an amenity or public works? And how do you differentiate between them being an amenity or public works, and what is the implication of them being public works? Does that have to do with bonding? Or?
It does. It has to do completely well with inspections and bonding, and Lawrence can chime in on this too if he wants, but right now, you know, we have planning and zoning inspectors that go out and inspect, you know, the subdivision itself and the layout of the subdivision. Then we have public works inspectors who go out and inspect the drainage, the roadways, you know, the cross, make sure the roads are built right and everything's done that way, you know, more of the site work itself, I guess. And there's been some question about, you know, within the county, within this building, you know, who's responsible for those, because it's never been clearly delineated, and, you know, what bonds it should be covered by. And the issue is that Public Works within the engineering department, you know, they have street cross sections, and they say, okay, you've got to have so many inches of, you know, asphalt and sub-base or whatever they call it, you know, so it's definitely spelled out. Right now, the sidewalks aren't in any spelled out, you know, set of guidelines. You got to look to the approval that came from planning and zoning for the project that may say, you know, it's one side of the street or both sides of the street, et cetera. So, you know, which that makes it sort of more of an amenity, you know, like a pool house that planning and zoning would inspect, because the pool house, say, was required by the Planning and Zoning Commission. I think that question of amenity versus public works gets answered if we come up with a set of standards that apply, because then we can put it on Public Works. And frankly, they're probably the better organization to inspect them when they're doing the roadways and everything else.
So, and typically, if the sidewalk is within the right-of-way boundary, it's automatically considered to be a jurisdiction of the Public Works section, because especially if you have curb. If it's curb and gutter, sidewalk's a piece of that project. The issue could become if it's outside the right-of-way, is it an amenity or is it a part of the street system, which it typically isn't. Yeah, on the lot, is it, we really haven't had anything where it says that the lot owner has to maintain his portion of the sidewalk, where a lot of towns do that. Mm-hmm. You have to maintain your sidewalk in front of your property, and a lot of the towns locally. And in some cases, the state gets involved in some of those issues, and you know, all the multimodal paths that are popping up here and there and everywhere all over the rural portion of Sussex County with these subdivisions, and there's not much else out there but a multimodal path. That's a separate issue. That's typically on the land of the development, but it's a requirement of the state.
I guess the first question, is there a consensus that, you know, we should be dealing with requiring sidewalks at all? You know, I mean,
I think we have to address it simply because if we don't, that it will continue to be an amenity that may or may not be proffered by a particular developer, and there'll be no real uniform rhyme or reason to the way it's done. My concern is that I don't want it to be so restrictive that there isn't some flexibility there to allow folks to do other things in the most efficient way possible.
And in both Newcastle County and Kent County, there is sort of an opt-out, you know, and it says, well, for example, in Kent County, there's, you know, if there's a significant adverse environmental impact caused by the sidewalks, they can ask for relief. That's just one example. And then in Newcastle County, they also say, and we'd build this in too, just so it's not hard and fast, but unless determined by the commission that sidewalks on only one side of the street are warranted, you know, if they were required to be on both sides, for example. You know, and I think, you know, that's typical for how the county's dealt with, like, parking requirements, for example. They say, this is what's required. If you can show good reason for it to be different, you know, then the commission would consider.
But to expand upon that, even if we have a subdivision application and there's a requirement in the code that they have to have sidewalks, then the applicant would have the right to ask for a waiver in the sidewalk requirement and do it in the public hearing process. Yeah. We do that now on some of the buffer issues and a few other things.
Right. But at least we would have dealt with it up front. You know, we'd have a rule and we'd have dealt with the waiver at the time of the hearing rather than sort of on the back end after the preliminary hearing has been done. And you know,
I think what happens is that sidewalks get proffered, and then when they get down to actually designing the project, for one reason or another, the sidewalks become an issue for them, either design or cost or both. And so then they're back in, and who does what at that point?
Or on purpose?
Well, I guess that's a possibility. I'm kind of taking the high road with these guys, but I guess someone could. Offer something and then with the intention of pulling it back later, but In any event, having you know, something in the ordinance about it will take care of any of those issues. So,
Vince, on the cluster, a cluster, the ordinance is a cluster must have sidewalks?
Yeah, well, the way the cluster subdivision ordinance was modified a couple years ago, yeah, if you went through and you wanted to, you could get expedited treatment back when we had 2 years waiting list. What you would do is you would show that your project is a superior design, and there was a laundry list of things that you had to do and improve. And one of those was that sidewalks must be on at least one side of every street. Now, we haven't had anybody come through that, only because we haven't had the need for expediting somebody's application since that ordinance amendment.
But you could still today do a cluster, get the reduced lot.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have to then put the sidewalks?
No, you could opt for the clustered subdivision reduced lot
without a sidewalk.
Without the requirement that there's sidewalks. That's
so
right.
So the expedited process initiated the
yeah,
sidewalk.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I guess just looking at what other jurisdictions do is certainly a method, at least a starting point or something. It's a reference. But understanding the logic behind why a jurisdiction chose one set of rules over another seems to me to be important. And I think we do need to address the issue, because what's happening is sidewalks are not, quote, required under particularly any circumstance. I mean, sometimes we'll require them after the fact or ask for them and or they'll be proffered. And that's one of the reasons we run into problems, is because they're not required. They're not engineered in up front. Mm-hmm. A road's required. They're engineered up front. The drainage is required. That's engineered up front. So when you come in the back door with engineering, you have mistakes, and things don't fit right. And this is what we're headed to try to resolve, so that we know pretty much in advance there's going to be some other areas of flexibility, but pretty much in advance we know where we need to start fitting these blocks in up front and planning a project for the developer or the property owner.
And the developer and engineers know that up front too.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
But in doing that, I think we need to know why we're asking for it. What's the logic? Is it for every road just because it's so many homes? I mean, if that's the case, then our highway system is messed up. We have arterial roads. We have major collectors, et cetera. We don't treat every road alike, even though they're all interconnected. Why would we treat all sidewalks alike in a community, whether it's an RPC, a cluster, a regular subdivision, when one might be a 5-home cul-de-sac,
right,
and it might build down with 100 or several hundred homes to adjacent to a commercial center and an RPC? So we may have a situation where one end of that RPC virtually has no sidewalks, the streets are their sidewalks, to one sidewalk, to two sidewalks, to wide pathways. I mean, so I would like to know what the logic is to, so that when we make a decision, we're making it based on, I don't know, you know, how many people, if there's mixed uses, commercial uses, you know, are they going to be used? Are they going to be needed? Or are we just simply going to make ourselves feel good because we have a rule?
Well, and kind of just, you know, I don't want to presuppose how the commission or the county would plan these, but sort of thinking through this and noodling through it a little bit with Lawrence and Shane, you know, over the probably past couple years when it's come up, to get back to your question of, you know, what makes sense and what's the logic behind it, you know, like one reasonable example would be, you know, that you have to have some sort of sidewalks in a project that's in a developing area over some lot threshold. The reason for that is developing areas tend to be surrounding towns or areas where there's lots of infrastructure. They also tend to be the developments that have smaller lots, and if you get those developments in those areas with smaller lots and you have over a certain number of lots, that's when you have the amenities package with the clubhouse and the pool house, where you've got some place that people are trying to get to. You know, I don't want to say that it should be like amenity driven. In other words, if you have a pool and a clubhouse and tennis courts, you got to put sidewalks in, because then nobody would put that stuff in just to avoid the sidewalks. You know, we were trying to kind of look at, all right, as a generalization, what types of subdivisions, you know, have the most need for it, I guess. And I don't know whether one side or both sides is the right answer either. You know, that's a planning issue.
I think this is the reason for taking a public works perspective, is that the sidewalk is part of the transportation system. It facilitates pedestrian traffic.
Right.
And the question is, do we want to do that? You know, and if we do, then what's the, you know, under what circumstances and what's the best way? And that's what we're trying to get to. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's if you have reasons to move people, then you certainly want to have a means to get there.
And the other, and I would just say, adding on to what I just mentioned too, the other sort of factor that goes into that is the developing areas, larger subdivisions, smaller lots, just has more vehicular traffic where you'd want to get the people potentially off the roads.
Yeah, because when there's no sidewalk, they're walking in the street.
But can we require the interconnectivity? I mean, in Arbor of Cottagedale, for example, it was suggested that interconnectivity exists between the major subdivision next door and Arbor's, but it never occurred because the people that lived in the community didn't want the interconnectivity. So again,
I'm not talking about interconnectivity. I'm just talking about
about developmental zones and connecting businesses and walking paths and all that. If you don't have interconnectivity, it doesn't work. I mean, so it has to be able to, that a person doesn't hit a dead end at the end of their sidewalk and now have to go out on the street to get through the development to get to their local food place. So that, you know, if we're talking about planning so that we move from the densest areas, the areas that we have as our targeted growth areas, and say, well, that's a reason to require sidewalks, well, then it's not a reason if you don't have interconnectivity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure.
You can't cross a river without a bridge.
Yeah, but we're not talking about interconnectivity between properties. I mean, it's just within the subdivision itself. You know, I mean, certainly if you're going to propose a roadway and there's two, you know, I mean, that's a separate issue. I'm really just trying to figure out what the standards are for within the subdivision, not inter. Because I know what you're saying, right? When you had cottages of Arbordale or Arbors of Cottagedale or whatever it was, there was sort of that road to nowhere because they wouldn't agree to the, you know, the access from the other property. What we need to do is figure out if we want them and what the standards are going to be for interior sidewalks, for interior roadways.
Well, and I mean, I hate to beat the horse to death, Vince, but, you know, I think we need to look at legally what we can require on the interconnectivity as well to see how it fits in.
But we can require it. I mean, that's the easy answer. We put it in the code, we can do it.
But it has to go in the code.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
That it can be required. Yeah. And. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're looking at an area such as that particular application where it is building and it's going to continue to build when this economy gets through, that it makes sense that that walkway become usable to the public. And I know that there's some pain that goes with that because there's communities and people don't want people walking through their communities, but it's like living in town. I mean, that's what happens. That's how things evolve. So, again, there's two things that I would like to see. One, I'd like to see the logic behind what we're going to propose. I'd rather not see us just do it because some other jurisdiction did it. When I was a kid, they said, monkey see, monkey do, and monkey get in trouble, too. So give me the logic behind it, you know, and then if it's logical, then I think it's something we can digest and agree upon. And also, I think we have to... once we have the logic, understand what is our ultimate goal. I mean, are we going to connect it to other areas of our planning process, or are we just going to treat it as a separate little thing, you know, like you mentioned, just solve the issue within a subdivision? My opinion would be that that would be a mistake. And I think we need to think along the lines that at some point, all those streets are going to create a community. And if you don't allow that community to connect, then you have a lot of little small pathways to nowhere that won't really function to get people off the streets and that have a usable walking pathway system.
Well, I mean, the first one with the logic, sort of the threshold question is, we need to deal with it. I mean, you know, and I'm not suggesting that Kent County, Newcastle County is right, but we can't continue, you know, on the sort of like we're doing the time extensions. You know, we need to get something that's set down. This is what everybody knows, like you're saying, so engineers and developers know what the requirements are. You know, I suppose we've talked about it before. Is there any thoughts from the commission as to, you know, the logic for requiring subdivisions, or that, you know, particular projects need subdivisions or need sidewalks, and here's why? I mean, you know, we can go, me and Andrew and, you know, whomever can find logic aplenty for why we need sidewalks, but I'd like to hear the thoughts of the commission too on that subject. Because there's all kinds of planning studies that'll tell you that, you know, you need that for pedestrian movement within a subdivision. I mean, you know, I probably could find ones that say you don't need pedestrian movement within a subdivision. I'd sort of like to hear what, you know, the commission like thinks on that.
I think they're asking the commission to hit, do we want sidewalks or not, is really what, you're, what
yeah.
you're saying. So then you say, okay, well, at what level? Do you want it with a 15-unit subdivision or 150? And I don't know that that is an important as, you know, connect, like an MRRPC. I think there is something. If you're going to do commercial and residential, and then okay, there's going to be a reason, and we would, should probably encourage people to use pedestrian traffic. But if you have pedestrian to get to the commercial, but a 150-unit subdivision somewhere that has no commercial entities, that, you know, is there a need? Is there a need for a sidewalk? Or as a developer, do I think it's an amenity that would help me sell my development over one that doesn't? And I think it has to do with, like what you said, is connected to town centers or areas where people are encouraged to walk and will walk, and then you have to get them safely to their destination.
I think we have to be careful that you don't create an incentive to do subdivisions in places that don't require sidewalks and so on, though. My concern would be that if we're too focused on providing connectivity to something outside of the subdivision, then you know how many of these subdivisions we get that are essentially out in the middle of nowhere that many people think shouldn't be done in the first place. But my concern is if you can do that and avoid certain requirements if you're closer to town, so to speak, which is where you know, at least the state says they want development to go, we're kind of at cross purposes. So I really think it, in my mind, it probably has more to do with what's going on in the subdivision. And generally, I think sidewalks are a good idea. Somebody might take a walk if there's a sidewalk. Walking is good for you. You know, I'm not saying there shouldn't be a law that you have to take a walk. It should be an option. But you should have a safe place to do it if you want to.
Do you think there's any difference between a wider street and a sidewalk?
Yeah, I think there's a difference, but, you know, whether or not it's, you know, I don't know if it's a material in a smaller subdivision, maybe you can have instead of a bicycle path, you can have a walking path. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a way to deal with it, but, you know,
it would be less, I guess, cost less.
Yeah, yes. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the old saying in government and politics, no matter what you're talking about money. And you know, and I think we're all sensitive to that. You know, nobody wants things to cost any more than they need to, but, at you know, there's got to be a threshold at which, though, there's some kind of standard, you know, and that's what I think we need to find. So,
gentlemen, I'm inclined to go with the concept of density more so than I would be the number of units in a project, because I think we've all seen the projects that have come before us that come in at 49 lots. And gee, I wonder why they come in at 49 lots versus 50. Oh, an extra layer of review. Right, Brian? I think he's back there somewhere. We were just talking about how many projects come through with 49 lots instead of 50, because that avoids plus.
For the record, Brian Hall with the Office of State Planning, that is correct. We oftentimes see projects come in at 49 units to avoid the 50 threshold. Also, you can sometimes, is the magic 99 number, that's the DENREC requirement for septics. Those two can act as triggers in that circumstance.
And we've seen that happen here.
At least once.
Yeah.
So, and plus the idea, the reason why I like the density piece versus the number is because, just like we're going to see in a few minutes, perhaps, how you connect the dots. You know, we have one project here, and then next door we have another one, and another one, and after a while, you know, we really have 250, you know, buildable lots that are in a very small area. So I like your idea of the connectivity. I think that's critical. But I think we have to be forward-thinking, not just looking at just that piece in and of itself. I also beg to differ with your commentary about Newcastle County being all urban, because on this side of the canal, there's lot more farmland. Right. And they're experiencing that problem because now they're having a lot of developments that we could be replicating in the future, where if we just, you know, if we do it by number versus, number of lots versus the density, we could be not be forward thinking.
Yeah, those are just, sort of ideas that had been tossed around. The one thing, if we go by zoning, we have the benefit of, for example, the MR and the GR zones being in essentially mainly developing areas anyway. And so if you own or you buy a piece of property to develop it that's zoned for those higher densities, immediately going in, this is what I've got to do. And then that takes out all the AR1 stuff that, probably doesn't need sidewalks, that's not in the developing areas, where you have the larger 3/4 acre lots, or the density of, 2 units an acre, which, is the lower density in the county. So
you'd have to tie that into the sewer. Because if you got standard septic system, the lot size doesn't change.
Yeah.
The 3/4 acre. So you got to watch whether it's, the issue would be whether it's got sewer capabilities for central sewer and central water, as to whether or not the density could be reduced.
That almost seems like, though, that's getting, that may be one that you would come in if you're in GR, because I think the greater majority of GR properties are probably where they're sewer planned or headed in the near future. It's probably a lesser likelihood that you'd be GR, for example, without sewer anytime soon, and then you could opt out because you're essentially at the AR density based on sewer. I don't know. I'm just sort of, like I said, noodling through different ideas.
Well, I also agree with Mr. Ross in that we have to have built into the ability to make changes as a per subdivision, because on the opposite end of the spectrum, we can have a unit that or piece of ground that has 100 acres of wetlands, which are not developable,
right,
and 100 acres of uplands, and they want to cram 300 homes on 100 acres, and what's really the density?
Right.
Well, I've been told the density is based on the whole 200 acres, not on the buildable acres. So I only operate on the buildable.
Well, that's another discussion
that's
right
another
there.
Discussion.
It sure is. Yeah, and it's one that we need to have. Yeah. So we feel very strongly both ways.
All four ways, I think.
Yeah, all four ways, yeah.
Well, or using Mr. Ross's analogy of the monkeys again, we can see no evil, hear no evil, and speak no evil about sidewalks.
There's got to be some threshold of population or density to use and need.
Yeah.
There's no need to have a sidewalk if it's not going to be used. It's just a waste of everybody's money.
And future money, too. That's my
absolutely
concern.
Absolutely. I mean, and there's only so much money out there. And I mean, just to do something because we feel good about it doesn't make any sense. And even though we may be in a dense area, an MRRPC or whatever, there's an end to the MRRPC where there's very little traffic, and that traffic builds up as it gets to the entrance to the MRRPC where everybody's driving in and out. So there's a whole different set of issues if you're living near the busy end versus the dead end.
Back end, too.
And so to have one shoe size fits all doesn't make any sense. At the same time, the back end might be directly abutted to another MRRPC, in which then we get interconnectivity questions. So I think it's not, I don't think it's fair, Vince, to ask me or the other commissioners. They can opine if they like, but I don't feel comfortable saying I feel comfortable with any of the suggestions because I don't have the information to feel comfortable with. I'd like to see some rationale, even if it's opposing rationale or whatever. Logic, it should be engineering logic. It shouldn't be my gut instinct, because we're going to require people to spend a lot of money and do a lot of maintenance. I think we need to have more some kind of certainty that we're at least somewhere near the bullseye. Maybe it's a lower threshold with options to higher thresholds. And we also have to, Bob mentioned this, but I mean, we want to encourage growth in those growth areas. We want to encourage maximizing densities in those growth areas because they open up mass transit opportunities and multimodal transportation opportunities. They decrease sewer and water and road infrastructure and all that. So we have to be careful not to be penalizing indirectly, not really a penalty, but requiring something of those people that are going to those upper limits that, and Bob mentioned this, and the lower limits, and actually getting the reverse process, pushing that growth out where the cost is less. So it's, I think it's a much more complicated issue than just saying, well, let's pick and choose between, oh, jurisdiction A, jurisdiction B, and jurisdiction C. I think it's much more complicated than that. And I would like to give it a lot more thought and have at least some basis so that I can say this is why I think jurisdiction A hit it, or maybe a combination of two jurisdictions is a better option. I don't feel comfortable in saying that I have an opinion one way or the other right now.
Well, I mean, the way I approached it is with those different examples is, you know, we've seen a number of subdivisions. We've seen the applicants come in and request them, and we've seen the folks come in and say we don't want them for these reasons, So, that's why I think, the question's relevant to the commission. You've heard all this information as the planning commission. Certainly there's some opinions on what makes sense and what doesn't. So that was the reason I posed that question. But certainly Andrew and I, we can come up with the logic behind how other jurisdictions have come up with the rules. I don't have any problem doing that. I think you're still back to the same question. Okay, here's a laundry list of reasons why we do sidewalks in different areas. You still got to use your planning judgment to figure out which one of them makes sense for Sussex County. So, I mean, I'm glad to, to put that data together. That's not a problem to do at all.
Well, Andrew, you've been researching this for a while. What do you think?
Well, my feeling on it is probably that that density is probably the most important factor.
Okay.
More than, that doing a district, basing it on districts, gets you pretty close, but ultimately, if you're putting a dense subdivision out in the middle of nowhere, you're sort of creating another little mini urban area. So,
you think that you can lead our council here into coming up with something for us to consider?
I don't know if I'm ready to do that, but I'll give it a shot.
Wrong answer.
Yeah, right.
I think what he means is not for free. He's not going to do that.
Well,
I don't blame you either, son. That's all right.
Getting paid, don't worry.
That's right. But, I think your perspective is important, and don't be afraid to express it when you guys are working together.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, recognizing this isn't a public hearing, but as far as a perspective, if Mr. Stewart, our director of county EMS, is here, I'd like to allow him to have the opportunity to perhaps shed a perspective as to how sidewalks may or may not impact his department's abilities to do their job.
And as if we're going to have county folks, Mike Brady was invited to this meeting too because he heads public works, so he may want to chime in on the amenities versus public works too. I didn't realize he was in the audience.
I think that'd be helpful if you'd acquiesce.
Sure, come on up.
I'm getting paid, right?
No, but you are getting timed, so go ahead.
Good question.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the invitation. My name is Robert Stewart. I'm the director of Sussex County EMS, and I was asked to give my opinion about sidewalks. I had a brief discussion earlier with, I don't know which gentleman was called me, but one of them called me and talked to me about sidewalks. And from a public safety perspective, sidewalks are absolutely the Cadillac for public safety providers. It gives us an opportunity to get a person who's in need from a residence to a sidewalk next to an ambulance in a safer manner. A hard surface, the wheels on the stretchers are much more conducive to a hard surface versus trying to navigate across stepping stones, stones that are set between two by fours, across driveways that are all different kinds of shapes, sizes, and construction materials. And where anywhere we go where we have sidewalks, it's much easier job to get the patient into the ambulance. Also in many urban areas, most of the requirements are that the sidewalks be clear. So most of the time when we go up there in inclement weather, it's an opportunity to get to the residents quicker because we don't have to figure out a pathway across a snowbanked front yard or whatever. Some people sometimes clear off of what they thought was their sidewalk, and it's a pathway to their house, and it's very difficult to navigate across the snow, whereas when you clean the sidewalk off, you generally get it right down to the concrete. So from that, my daughter happened to live in a subdivision over in Rehoboth a few years ago, and what I noticed from a public safety perspective, it keeps the children out of the streets. In a lot of cases, they play on the sidewalks versus playing around parked cars, making games up in the street because they can actually play a little bit on the sidewalks. So, and from a walking perspective, as we all probably know, walking is much easier on a sidewalk than across and around a neighborhood. I think density has a lot to do with it. When it comes from taking off my public safety hat to trying to put on your hat, I would absolutely think that density has a lot to do with it because of the amount of sidewalk that you're going to have to provide in areas where lots are large. And also when you get farther and farther back in subdivisions, sometimes perhaps the reasons for having sidewalks kind of diminish as you go back further and further where there's less people in larger lot sizes. But from our perspective, absolutely selfish. We'd love to have sidewalks. And I think it keeps the public safer in most of these subdivisions that have high densities. High density generally brings a lot of not necessarily foot traffic, but vehicular traffic, because people have to park somewhere. And getting into and going out through driveways and trying to get people into ambulances in the streets puts us also in harm's way, because you got to navigate around vehicles that are navigating through trying to figure out what's going on, and you're not adjacent to a sidewalk where you can easily move to where your ambulance is parked. You have to navigate off the driveway, and generally when there's an emergency, there's more than one family member there and the driveways are clogged. So we're selfish. We'd love to have sidewalks, so whatever you come up with, we'll love you for it.
Well, I appreciate you sharing your perspective with us. I'm not sure that's one we had thought a lot about, actually being a public safety issue, but now that you mention it, it's important. All right, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
What's coming up? Well, Mike's coming up, but the just observation in Georgetown, see a lot of walkers just riding in that town. Right. Most of the walkers that are walking for cardiovascular reasons are actually taking a real walk. They're walking on the street next to the curb. They're not walking on the sidewalk because every driveway got a downward lean to it, and they don't want to walk over that down in that drop and then come back up again. They want to stay where it's flat. So, I mean, that's what they do in town. Most of them really walk on the street.
John, this is Mike Brady, and he runs the Public Works Department, so he's the guy that goes out and inspects all the subdivisions that you all approve for the roads and things like that. So we wanted Mike to come, and also Mike Izzo, although he's out today, just so he could sort of explain the amenity versus public works conundrum that we're in and sort of how that affects you and maybe anything you have to say on in terms of plan review and inspections, whether there's any difference between having sidewalks or not, or you know the issues we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. So.
Good afternoon. I've had a lot of discussion with Andrew and Lawrence and Shane, and I really respect their thinking on it, and I thank them for the work that they've put into it, and I thank the commission for considering it. After you approve a development, we're the ones that get the plans, the construction plans for the private roads, and we have to review it.
The words "we get stuck with it" go through your mind? Because it went through mine.
For developments that have smaller lots, that have closed drainage, in other words, curb and gutter drainage, as far as looking at it from the point of constructability and design, it's not so much a problem. But when we have subdivisions with larger lots, less density, open drainage, meaning a swale along the road, it's much more of a problem to design it and construct it. There's many different factors. There's drainage coming off of the lots, down the lot lines. How does it go over the sidewalk, under the sidewalk? The sidewalk probably shouldn't be next to the road. It should be on the lot side of the drainage swale, which means that when you get to the intersection or at some point where you want the sidewalk to cross the road, the sidewalk also has to cross the drainage swale. It's difficult to design and construct. So that's been probably the biggest issue for us. And we also see that when you require sidewalks on one side of the street, a lot of designers, they get up to a cul-de-sac and you either stop it at the neck of the cul-de-sac or they'll wrap it all the way around or they wrap it halfway around And I don't think, you know, on your end, you don't see that, but we see it at our end. And how do you there seems like small issues, but how should it be handled? So there's little issues like that, but I think the constructability is the biggest issue when we have the larger lots. And for us and the discussions that we've had with Lawrence and Andrew, it doesn't seem to make sense when you have whatever the magic number is as far as lot size, half acre or three-quarter acre lots, it doesn't seem to make sense to require sidewalks, although a developer might come in and want the sidewalk. So those are generally the issues with us, but I tend to agree with, I don't know if Lawrence has expressed his thinking on it. He has with me, and if he's done it with the commission, Public Works definitely agrees with his thinking on the sidewalk.
Hey, when you're talking about larger lots, you're referring to three-quarter acre or bigger?
Whatever that number is, yeah, half acre, three-quarter acre.
Half acre or whatever.
Okay. Seems like, though, a key factor in this design issue is open drainage or closed drainage or surface drainage. So that seems like that's, would you say that's the biggest?
I'd say, yeah, that's definitely one of the key factors in it as far as design and construction.
Right.
It's much easier with the closed drainage, with the curb and gutter.
Right. Which, of course, is a much more expensive proposition than surface drainage.
Right. And you generally see curb and gutter with the higher density, the smaller lines.
Correct.
Right.
Yep, that's true.
Where the sidewalk fits better.
Are the sidewalks being built with some angle so surface water runs off them? Or are they being built spot on dead level so when it rains, the water just stays on the sidewalk? You know, is there a little bit of a lean to it so it...
That's another issue.
Pitch.
Most all designers will put a 2% grade across the sidewalk so
Correct.
That there is some drainage. And the issue connected with that is whether the sidewalks need to be compliant with the American Disabilities Act as far as width. And in fact, we have, there were new road standards approved, a couple years ago now, and we have a construction detail for sidewalks. And there is a note on that detail that does require that they meet the American Disabilities Act requirements. And that one of the requirements is it can't be more than 2% slope across it, which is about a quarter inch in a foot of fall across the sidewalk. One of the other requirements, which we've been doing in the plans, which you should be aware of, is in the ADA requirements, if your sidewalk is less than 5 foot in width, then you have to have within every 200-foot intervals, a 5 foot by 5 foot wide section where wheelchairs could pass.
Mm-hmm. A turnout.
Mm-hmm. So I think the issue with this is some developers have brought to us, and I haven't found the answer yet, is in a private development, does the sidewalk have to be ADA compliant? And that's maybe a legal question. And that is on our standard construction detail, and it's what we've been enforcing with the developments with private roads, that they be ADA compliant. And I think that when that development's turned over to the homeowners, that gives them protection as well.
So what would being you brought up, what would be the standard sidewalk width? But we've seen quite a few different dimensions.
To be ADA compliant, it can't be less than 3 feet. But anything less than 5 feet requires those 5 foot by 5 foot passing areas within 200 foot intervals. So we see anything from 3 feet to 5 feet. And the 5 foot is obviously, it's a nicer walkway. It's, if you're less than 5 feet, it's very difficult for two people to walk side by side.
If you have a swale system with a 20-foot street, you need sidewalks on both sides. You all of a sudden got 30 foot, so you got to work your drainage into that 10 foot on each side.
Yeah, it's
makes it difficult.
It's very difficult.
Especially with the slope requirements that are necessary for trails.
Right. Yeah, when you're trying to fit that sidewalk on the lot side of the drainage swale, you have the back slope of that drainage swale coming up, and trying to fit it all in is extremely difficult.
Yeah, we saw that. We saw that issue on one project near Laurel a couple months back. It just wouldn't work.
Yeah. So that's probably, if you hear anything from me today, I'd say that when you require sidewalks and we have developments that have open drainage, the design and the constructability is a real problem for us. When you have curb and gutter, not a problem.
So much.
Yeah.
When you have the swales, what are your thoughts about having the walking paths adjacent or part of the asphalt? You know, instead of like a bicycle path they were talking about, a walking path, so that there's a defined area that's striped and, you know, that's, if you want to show the bicyclist and somebody walking or whatever, I mean, I saw those when I was up in Greenville yesterday. Yeah. You know, that on both sides of the road going up, they have the bicycle paths.
We've, and I wasn't director at the time, but when you first started to require sidewalks, we had a few come through like that, where the sidewalk was part of the asphalt of the road and it was striped to separate it. And I don't know if that would really be considered a sidewalk, if it's ADA compliant because it's connected with the road. I don't know the answer to that, but I can only give you my personal opinion, and everybody has different opinions about it, but I think that you have kids utilizing sidewalks, and I don't think it's a safe thing, you know. And then there's the thought, well, you're in a subdivision, whatever size it is, the speed limit's 25 miles an hour, maybe it is safe. But my personal opinion is I'd rather, if you're going to have a sidewalk, I'd rather it be separated from the roadway. I think it's a safer situation.
Okay.
I was just thinking whether that would be safer than nothing at all. Because now if we have the swales, then all we wind up is your standard width roadway, and if a car is coming at you, your choice is, do I dive into this 10-foot ditch and take my chances, or take the chance that I'm not going to get struck?
Yeah. No doubt better than no place to walk, or walking in the road, especially since, you know, our road is only 20 foot wide, minimum requirement. It's not a very wide road, and you put mailboxes down both sides of a 20-foot road, and it becomes very narrow.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Yeah, good job. Good job.
Well, I think I've got my marching orders.
We'll make this observation, though. We've heard density, density, and density.
Right.
All three of our experts testified to density being at least being a factor, so it would be something I would encourage you to consider anyway.
Density and the logic behind, like Marty asked, yeah, for the planning basis for having them in the first place.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
or what the thresholds would be.
Yeah, I think that density is the number, and then the flexibility might come into the logic.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, so, you know, use density plus the flexibility of logic. Is it an MRPC? Is it backed up to another major subdivision? I mean, we need, and then that would probably work for us.
Okay. All right, well, we'll get to work on that. I appreciate everybody's time and energy, and Mike's too, and the folks from EMS, just because we've dealt with them, the issue on, you know, like a one-shot deal on a subdivision that's in front of us. It's kind of useful to just talk about the issue itself, separate and apart from particular subdivision, and like hear from Mike, because I know I deal with public works on projects and issues they have to deal with, you know, and you all don't necessarily see that when a plan's approved, how it goes through their shop, and they've got to deal with the practical and engineering aspects of it, so I think that's pretty useful. So I'll get all that information, me and Andrew will work on it with Lawrence and some other folks, and we'll get back to you with what we come up with. Okay?
All right, sir, thank you. Anything else on sidewalks? Okay, Community Viz. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, just need a minute to transition, so.
Okay. Smith, would you like to tell a few jokes? Or,
it's a transition, like,
whatever.
Into a butterfly.
It's a transition. It's kind of like a segue. You know?
Those of you who are going to stay for the presentation, feel free to move around to wherever you need to be so you can see it.
Do you need the lights dimmed?
Yeah,
they're all sure. The light switch will help you, Brian. That little black knob only does this one set of lights over the commission. You might have to hit a couple of the others.
That little better for everyone?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I can still rake.
A lot of light coming in on the screen.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to do much about that.
I have to say, we know how to clear a room here.
You do need to introduce yourself if you get a chance.
We'll go ahead and get started then if...
And you are?
Getting to that, good sir. For the record, my name is Brian Hall. I'm with the Office of State Planning and Coordination. Here with me today, to my right, is Mr. Bill Gowan with University of Delaware Extension. There next to him is Ed Lenandowski with Sea Grant, Community Outreach Specialist, also with the university. And then to the rear, also with Sea Grant College, is Ms. Carol Basin, whom all have been responsible and played a very integral role in what you're going to be seeing today. We're going to introduce you to a couple of different things. We're going to give you an opportunity to play because this is really part of this whole tool and tool set that we bring to you today. So as I said, real brief introduction. We're going to talk about tools. We're also going to talk about a process. These tools are really nothing unless there is some kind of process that allows you to get to what you're trying to decide and how you're trying to implement something within your community, whether it's sidewalks, sewer, water, etc. We're going to let you play, as I said, a simple planning exercise. We're going to allow you then to move to where we are today, to the next generation, which is the WE table, and we'll talk about that. And then, of course, really allow you as questions throughout this whole process. This is very informal. I want you all to throw things at me if you feel inclined to do so. I just ask that if they're water bottles, they're only half full. In this case, what are we really looking at here? From our perspective, we look at the idea that this is a public process. We are trying to find new and inventive ways to engage the public, to engage our civic leaders in having a conversation on immediate issues, whether it be land use, whether it be sewer, water. Again, we want to capture your thoughts and concerns, and they're going into this master plan process, and we'll talk about that briefly here in just a second. We want to provide predictability. We've all heard that story. We go into a local jurisdiction. We don't know what the standards are. Therefore, it costs us money in the end. Build consensus, and then also have shovel-ready projects. We know that planning does work. If we have the things there, the tools are there, the answers to the questions are there, then the big fish come, the Amazons come, the larger manufacturers, whether they be a Ford or a Chrysler, are then there to able to come into a community and provide those things that we look for every day. What is a master plan? This is where we are moving to now, and in the perspective that this is now going down one level below your comp plan. Comp plan is up there at 100,000 feet. It's our wishful thinking, our thoughts, our goals that we'd like to be. The master plan is where we put rubber to the road. We begin to answer those tough questions about costs, where we're going to make these investments, how we're going to do them, and who is ultimately then responsible for. So really, it's intended to address a variety of issues that transcend local levels, again, growth, development, transportation, property rights, civic and community values, housing, air, water, etc. So where have we done this? This is not something new. This just happens to be here in Sussex County. This process has been ongoing throughout the state. Its first intervention was actually on 202 in Newcastle County and has since grown to where we are now here in Sussex County, to where we have the Chesapeake Watershed Study Area, which is a result of the Chesapeake Bay TMDLs. We have the Southeast Milford Master Plan, which was done based upon the desire to grow and expand medical services and create jobs. The Cape region for its unique character and what it provides to the county as well as the state. The Georgetown Master Plan, and then also, of course, what we'll be talking about today, which is within the larger scope there of the watershed, is Bridgeville and Greenwood and addressing their immediate issues. So what are our tools? Well, we have two. One is the WE table. That is the video game process. That is where we get you to play and interact and have fun. The other is the land use model. One is basically, alone by itself is an okay tool, but together it becomes a very powerful tool, and we'll highlight that. So Planning 101, we're going to introduce you right now to what is the model. Why do we talk about models? Well, models are just one way to try to get to an answer, to try to answer a question. No one model is correct. No one model is perfect. But what we try to do with our model is make it local and make it simple and user-friendly so we can have some good, positive conversation. We talk about density. We try to make a clear definition for folks because a lot of times when we engage folks at the local level, they have a very, should say, misunderstood definition of what density, zoning, and land use is. So we provide those basic definitions as part of this process. Our model focuses on density. That's what we're talking about. So how do we do this? Well, we have our county. It's divided up into 100-acre squares. Why 100-acre squares? Well, because that's the average plus project that comes through is roughly 100 acres. That's the average that we see. Also, we know that 100-acre squares are not parcel-based. That's very important. Why? Parcels are personal. How many of you have been to a DelDOT meeting, and the first thing you do when you walk into the room is you go up to a map, and what are you looking for?
Your house.
Your parcel, your house. You want to know what they're going to do to you. We try to work to diffuse that idea so that we give folks the opportunity to have a greater conversation about their community, therefore diffusing that potential frustration that might occur. So what's a 100-acre square? Well, for the sake of conversation, this is the Deltek campus here in Georgetown, and roughly 100 acres of the overall 150-acre parcel is developed. So all the buildings that you see there, the baseball field, that's roughly 100 acres. Okay, the model itself, what is it? Again, 100 acres. It's impartial, representative, reproducible. We wanted to make it simple, and that's what our goal was. We do allow for a general cross-census of general land use concepts, and we also have some custom land uses because we know that there are things local on the ground that are not addressed at a national level. It is numerical. We get scenarios out of this. We get numbers, dollars, and cents behind them. And we also have the ability, based on input from the local level, to be able to constrain those numbers. When we talk about Bridgeville and we talk about wastewater and wastewater usage, the average is 300 gallons a day. But based on their engineering information, we know that folks use 180 gallons per day. So therefore, we're able to implement those changes and make it personal to that local level situation. Okay, again, it is visual, it's deliberative, it's on the fly in real time. As we change and play today here in just a few minutes, the model and the computer behind it will be changing those numbers and be able to produce values. Gives us what ifs. We ask the questions, well, what if we did this versus that? Allows for trade-offs and discussions. Okay, and again, it's ready to use. It's simple, it's easy, and something that we're able to bring to a local jurisdiction now, in this case, without any problems. I apologize for the screw-up there. But again, we're looking at some of the parameters. We look at dwelling units. We look at the amount of square footage that comes with employment areas. We look at demographics, the number of folks, where they're traveling to, how they're traveling to. And then we have our out of play. And then, of course, we have our efficiencies. We realize, even though that it may say in our zoning code that there's the potential for 4 units per acre, but we know that when we start factoring in roads, stormwater, some of the other constraints, the actual potential of 4 units is reduced, and we may only end up with 3 units. So we're able to program that in to factor that in, again, giving real local information. So how does it work? Again, this is the model in real time, and you'll be seeing that in just a few moments. We have crayons. When this idea was created, the idea was is that we wanted it to be simple. We wanted nothing fancy. We said we wanted a set of crayons. Each crayon represents a different type of land use. And that crayon then, when you color it down on that piece of paper or now here on the computer screen, generates then a response and generates some information. So we have up to the potential of 16 different crayons, but when we engage a local jurisdiction, we try to keep that number much smaller. Again, based on what we know of the local area. For example, when we talk about Bridgeville and Greenwood, we know that the average density within that town is only roughly 4.5 units to the acre. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to give them a T16, which is the potential of 16 units for the acre, if that's something they don't even begin to address locally, either through building or through their own independent codes. So again, it's transect based. This is this form-based concept where we go from our rural areas all the way up to our larger areas. And what you see here, these are our standard 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. In this case, there's 7 crayons, but these are our 6 or 7 that we work with. Again, the 8 is an optional one based on the jurisdiction. So what do they look like? And I do apologize, this screen, I have some thoughts, but I'll behave myself today. But to give you an idea, rural communities, these are what Sussex County is today. If we turned on a map, we would still see that there's only really roughly one unit per 100 acres. We are still a very agroing community. We're big on agriculture, which is a very good thing. We also recognize, though, that we have rural units. In this case, we can have 5 units to 100 acres. That's what we typically see as the farm begins to subdivide, where we may have a strip lot created and or developed to help pay the bills or simply allow the kids to live on the farm. Our suburban mix, here's where we began to get into some of our other acres that you see here that allows for our residential development. 2 units per the acre is our traditional low density development here in the county. We have our T6, which is an urban mixed area. That would be something like potentially the Village of Five Points, where we have mixed use opportunities there for commercial as well as residential. And then our T8 is our more denser areas, perhaps like college apartments. But again, it also does allow for some mixed use associated with the project. Lastly, then, are our employment centers. Again, these are localized from the aspect that employment has no residential at all. These are our Walmarts, our schools. We also then, for some circumstances, we will work with the folks, play with them a little bit. If they're in areas where they wish to see expanded services beyond just a traditional school, fire, and police, and we have the ability to paint a very large retail center. So here's where I'm going to ask Bill to come up and step forward for a little bit. What we're going to give you all the opportunity is we're actually taking you right now through the mini process that we go through, and one of these exercises is allowing you as an individual or as a group to begin to paint your own town. So Bill's going to be handing out packets. I believe he's going to pair you up, and I'll get the lights here, and then I will let him to explain to you what the process will be.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill McGowan with the University of Delaware, and great to be here with you. Why don't we pair up, just two over there, Lawrence and Marty and Rodney and Mike and Bob, we'll go down here. So you can now open your packet, all right? So you have 2 things in your packet. We have 1, the game board. Got it? Here's the game board, which is the white tab, 11x17. And on the left of the game board is your tiles that Brian just reviewed for you. The T20, which is the rural, 5 dwelling units per 100 acres. And the T2 is more of a suburban. Actually, it's the existing AR residential zoning, if you will. Up there is the T6, the urban mix, which might be something more like the Village of Five Points. Or it is the Village of Five Points. And lastly, the T30 is the deployment piece. In the brown envelope are your tiles. And so now your task is to go to work and in a pair get me a community that you think would fit what would meet Sussex County standards. Do you want jobs? Do you want livability? Do you want walkability? Do you want open space? Do you want kind of large lot development? So go ahead, take some time, and on the game board, go ahead and put together something that you think your constituency might want or desire. And go ahead, just out of curiosity, does anybody know what you're starting with? What is the game board? If you had to kind of refer to it a tile, the game board is your basic, you're starting with 1 dwelling unit per 100 acres. So you've got 12 at 100, so you go ahead and rock and roll and get me something that you think would work.
Got one road.
Pardon me? Don't worry about the ditches.
Don't worry about the ditches?
Don't worry about ditches. Don't worry about the existing land use. It's just, come on, man. This is development in Sussex County. You can do what you want.
Definitely don't worry about sidewalks.
Right. Thank you.
And you want to cruise all these tops?
This is a competition. You will be presenting your designs to the Planning and Zoning Commission, and of course, there's a $25,000 take-home cash award on this one.
Can we spend it at the brick after the meeting?
Work out from the center.
Sort of.
Where's your employment center?
Is this a road?
Yes. Yeah, I was thinking maybe we'll put that off to one side. That's 12.
You can utilize
it. Oh, it's a little less density.
This would be reminiscent of
Out a little bit to the less dense stuff.
And each one
more brush to do.
Each one square.
Yeah, I don't think we should.
Bless you.
We don't have enough for these.
This is what the T2, which is two dwelling units per acre.
Because I think you want, don't you want the population density closer to the employment?
And then you got residential.
Yeah, I mean.
I think you're going to want to.
We have to use all of these?
Like I said, don't worry about what the picture is.
Move it over here.
Right. So you want to just put these.
You can use.
Maybe in a center, should they be?
As what? What's a default?
The default is 1 unit per 100 acres.
I got you. So there you go. I see what he's saying. So we could do.
Do you want another?
I would have as many rules as I wanted.
That's interesting.
Make it a little bit. We offset it. This is the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
Like that? Hey, do you see the girl in that little bikini?
That's another one of these.
Working our way back. You have to use my glasses.
Keep that one.
And then just sort of keep this wooded area here.
I'm with you.
Put that up there. To the extent that I understand.
Semi-reasonable, I guess.
One of these papers.
You're going to fill the whole thing up.
I mean, that's the theory.
We could do some agriculture.
Yeah, the density. As you go out from the town.
Remember, he built 7 Christiana Malls the last time.
Maybe one of these goes.
Down to 113.
Follows the logic of density around the employment. Whether we shift it this way so it's center. In terms of.
It's a really.
That's too much one spot.
I feel like any answer is the wrong answer.
Two rurals and a suburb.
Y'all just about done?
Yep.
Thoughts? This Lawrence and the crew, what do you got?
Yeah, that's.
First thought was to not put any tiles on
the whole thing.
Good.
1 unit per 100 acres.
Over here, Marty and Rodney. What did we end up doing? I know Marty was talking about the Atlantic Ocean. What did we do?
We were trying to have a little piece of beach there so we had good scenery.
Well, you went dense and then kind of moved it out to.
That's what we did too.
We said that first, but then we
shifted it out.
Industrial center, high density, then density reduces to back to the.
I just brought up a question of if I was in a rural area. How far would I be from shopping services, and what would I have to
drive through, you know.
Yeah, to get there,
increasing
right.
Increasing traffic to get there. So it might be nice to maybe have something in that rural area that I want to go have some goods and services.
Right.
I wouldn't have to drive that far away from my community. But we didn't. I didn't move any tiles. Thank you.
All right, good.
Guess.
Mike, Bob?
Well, we started out with the employment as a center, and then we, around the four sides, we put the most dense population, and then, you know, stepping out, you know, to the least dense area.
Okay. And again, over here, fairly high density, right? You did the same thing. And
we just basically the same thing.
Yeah. All right, good. So this is just a very simple introduction to that tool. So I think what Ed and Brian are going to take you through is, what happens is that every one of those things represents numbers, and the model literally can crank those numbers out. So if you're sitting there and you say, well, okay, I like a medium residential development over here, what are the implications for Sussex County? Well, it means water and wastewater. It means vehicle miles traveled. It means everything else. So you literally get to think about real-time application of your decisions. Now, if you don't like it, the good thing about this is, the back end, what was it, Ed? A number two pencil isn't any good if it doesn't have an eraser. Something like that? So that's what you get to do. You get to put it on the ground, try it, run the numbers, and then make your decisions based on that. So with that, thanks for engaging. If you don't mind, put that stuff back in into the little envelopes, and we'll use them again. Okay? Thank you very much.
The chickens are ready to move out of this chicken house. I'm just telling you, in this hot weather, you should go ahead and get them out of
none of this. Yeah, really.
And it's not good for chickens, I can tell you.
You're not going to have urban anyway,
really. I'm on both ends of that equation.
Better than the big sheet you gave us at the farmer's center.
No, and
last year.
Right.
And it's place.
Yeah,
and this is just kind of the one.
Yeah.
And it's artificial because
you don't know what's beyond the
permanent. And it's pretty skewed.
Not fair where you were.
Where is it? Where is it? Picture of you, know?
I think that actually isn't the scale.
We were trying to figure out where it was. That one road and a lot of text that just.
They're all like
mosquito control.
I think it's anywhere.
All like that in Sussex County.
Okay.
It's anywhere.
What you just saw was the old way of doing business. We've done this, as I've shown you in the previous slides, across the county as well as across state now. And in the old days, we would take and hand everybody cute little squares and a roll of scotch tape, and we would say, start taping. And if you can envision a study area that right now you only had a dozen squares. In the case of Georgetown, we had about 130 squares. In the case of the Chesapeake Bay, we have several thousand squares. So the concept of having some poor soul in their evening volunteering their time taping, as you can imagine, is not very appealing. And from our perspective, it wasn't very appealing when it came time to cut all those little squares out in anticipation of that meeting. So what we've done is we've taken to the next step, and that's what we're going to be bringing you down here very shortly to be able to utilize and play with, but we're going to be using a real, live, local scenario. You've heard me talk quite a bit about Bridgeville and the Greenwood and the Master Plan and the Chesapeake Bay. Well, we know that we have this Bay Initiative. We know that we have requirements that have come down to us that we have to do, but putting all of that aside, we have a local situation that is very real. We have a failing wastewater treatment plant. If you've not had the chance to tour the plant was actually constructed in 1956, and the original BNR generator is still in operations today. From that perspective, the technology has become very outdated, and it is old, and it fails. We have a situation where at some point in time, based on some good planning principles, a working relationship was created to address Greenwood's failing septic systems within its local jurisdiction, and now the two towns share this same failing plant. So regardless of whether we had the Bay situation, regardless of whether we had state and local requirements that would say we need to clean the water, we have good business that needs to be addressed. Folks are looking for the ability to flush their hoppers, and there may come a point when that's no longer there. So again, we've created this scenario where we look at it as a watershed scale based on the Bay requirements, because that's what they asked us to do. But then really what we began to look at is both of the local jurisdictions. What you see here is their comprehensive land use plan. Town of Bridgeville there is the first one. Greenwood is the one there in the center. Both of them have a desire to grow. They wish to annex. But we realize that for them, either one of them to grow, they have to be able to flush the hoppers. And that's something that, again, may be iffy down the road. We also recognize that, again, we are in an environmental area. It is a very unique area. We're in the headwaters of the Nanticoke River watershed, and we have this opportunity to address a localized problem and get some real bang for our bucks if we're talking about the Bay and the TMDL. So what are some common themes that we have? We have both this desire of residential. We have communities that wish to value and retain their agricultural character and their tie to the land, promote that as an economic business and entity, as seen here from the local feed mill that's family owned and operated to the large scale commercial operations on the edge of either town, as well as some unique environmental features, as I said. These are things that the community brought to the table while, again, trying to figure out this infrastructure situation. So what did we do? What you see right now here are some very real examples of what the folks did as part of this ongoing effort to refine a study area within their part of the world, consider some different scenarios, and then, again, as Bill said, as we showed in other slides, give us the numbers behind that so folks can make some informed decisions. So we have the existing base. We always start with the existing base because that's the snapshot on the ground. That is real information. It's captured and collected based on local census information. We look at the 911 structure files that are provided by the county. We use aerial interpretation, and we also use our land use cover files that are in place at the state level to give us a snapshot of what's on the ground. A lot of green there, still very rural. We always show what the scenario would be if, in fact, the comp plans were to build out in someone's lifetime, not necessarily mine, but someone's. We show that we have that transition from our agricultural to low density, and then, of course, as the comprehensive plans that are in place show the development occurring around both towns. But then we give them some options. We give them some thinking points and some suggestions. We have two other scenarios that come to play. One is an economic development scenario there on your lower left. Gives us an idea of what would happen if we expand employment centers, if we created opportunities and created a link to the agricultural lands and tried to work to determine what is that nexus to grow that industry as well as sustain that locally. And then we always have an O factor to get people talking. The one on the lower right there is a megagopolis scenario where the two towns simply grow together and we now have either Bridgewood, Greenville, or some combination thereof. Again, it gets them talking and thinking amongst themselves, again, understanding what the scenarios might be. And again, the same scenario, so you're going to present it, but again, we show you what you can get out of this. We talk heavily about wastewater because wastewater is our driving issue here and how we can address that and begin to plan for that. This master planning process is not just about what we're doing here with the model, but again, if you recall, it's talking about the rubber that meets the road. When the local jurisdictions go through the planning process and identify a scenario, that scenario then triggers the engineers, whether it be the wastewater engineers, the road engineers. It triggers the local business community from a realtor's perspective. Can this work if we allow for these types of uses? They then begin to give us the information that puts the costs and the real dollars and cents to building a scenario that would work for the communities. So now with that being said, this is where we're going to ask you to get up from your table. I'm going to allow Ed to take over and demonstrate to you the WE table, talk a little bit about the WE table, and also allow you to actually plan in the working scenario that is Bridgeville and Greenwood. You'll have the opportunity to paint this just with some of the very crayons that you saw. The model will run the numbers, and your scenario then can be produced out to give you an idea of what it's actually going to be on the ground, dollars and cents. Number of people, number of homes, commercial, residential, taxes, vehicle miles, the whole nine yards to be able to try to answer those questions that the public typically brings to us. So, gentlemen, if you would.
Steve is running. Boy, he can't pick anything up. They're going to do this.
Okay, good afternoon. Ed Lewandowski, Delaware Sea Grant. This is the Wii table. Mine showed you up on the presentation. It's spelled W-E-E-A-B-L-E, which is actually a play on the technology that it uses, which is the Nintendo Wii technology. Technology was pioneered down in Texas. My colleagues at Texas Sea Grant came up with the components of the Wii table. They did that in collaboration with Placeways Incorporated, which is a spinoff of the Horton Family Foundation. Those folks are interested in citizen engagement and planning at the community level, decision-making at the community levels. And that's basically what we're trying to do here, is gather people around the table, allow them to participate in a GIS exercise. So this is geospatial planning. What we have, as far as the components of the Wii table, standard laptop, which is running two software applications. One is called Community Viz, that hosts the university's land use model. The other is Smoothboard. That is the actual smart board technology, which allows us to turn this into an interactive computer interface. And you just saw that. I was interacting. I was interacting by way of an infrared pen. This is a Wii remote. Anybody play the bowling, the tennis, fishing? When you go home and entertain yourself, same concept. This is the Wii remote, which has an optical sensor that actually tracks the infrared light at the end of this pen. So it's following the pen as it moves around the table. It's communicating with my laptop via Bluetooth technology, so that's how everything is linked together. So we are projecting an image right now of our laptop monitor, so whatever you see on the laptop, you're seeing here, and however you might interact on your laptop with a mouse, you're doing it right here on the tabletop with an infrared pen. So that's the idea. So what I'd like to do is just, I'm going to bring up blank screen again. Maureen, that's right.
What do you want me to draw?
I want you to take the infrared pen, press it to the tabletop, press in this black button, write your name. Write your name.
You know I failed penmanship.
Not bad. Good job. It's the same technology that our teachers use in the classroom with our kids using whiteboard technology. That's done on a vertical plane. What we've done here is just moved it to the horizontal plane. What we found is, and we were concerned that it would inhibit conversation when people move around a table, but we found that it actually enhances conversation. People really get into it, all ages. We had some folks that first said, you know, I'm a little leery of this. I'm not used to this type of technology. But once they get down and they see the power that the tool offers us, they really get into it, and it really enhances the conversations that they have. Anybody else just want to practice? Give it a shot. Everybody good? Okay. What we're going to do is close out of the smart board technology and bring up ArcGIS, which is running our Community Viz software and the university's land use model. Brian showed this image already on the screen. This is the base build-out scenario for the town of Bridgeville and the town of Greenwood. ArcGIS gives us the capacity to have a number of layers of data right here on the map. We can bring up railroads. We can bring up groundwater recharge areas. We can bring up state wetlands maps. So all that data is behind the map, and when people have a question or they want to see a presentation of that data to help them in their decision making, it's right here at our fingertips. Okay, so we don't have to go in a room with 10 different maps, 12 different maps. It's right here at one location. So I'm going to ask Carol to come over. Carol's actually the architect of the university's land use model. She is a land use planner, has great background in GIS, and she's going to show you the paint application, the one that actually allows us to color the landscape using those colors and the tiles so that we can begin to see how the changes that we're making on the landscape impact certain data categories, as Bill mentioned, whether it's population, vehicle trips, waste load allocation, whatever you might desire. So Carol, I'm going to give you the floor.
First of all, I think it might be of interest to you. Ed was talking about the layers that we can bring up. One of the layers we bring up is out of play, which are ag easements, state lands, areas that are unbuildable. So the system actually takes out these pieces when the build out is run, and it says, okay, you can't build here, but I'm going to squish it into that 300 acres up on the top of the hill, and it takes care of it. But it doesn't put 300 units there. if there are 200 units allowed, 100 units may be put there. So it's a little bit different in that respect. Also, besides out of play, you might be familiar with the growth areas, the districts from the comp plan. We can add those, we can overlay them, and we can actually see where the comp plan, the Sussex County comp plan, wants or might be annexation areas or areas in the comp plan that would be suggested for growth. So as Greenwood and Bridgeville are looking at where they want to grow, we actually have these overlays there. So I'm going to turn them off because I don't get them in the way now. So we have those things to look at. Maybe I'll turn back the out of play. All right, so we saw that the town of Bridgeville had a growth area coming down this way. So where would you like to grow? I'm going to start my edit. I'm going to edit that. And I'm going, these are our land use categories. You saw the crayons, which are actually land use categories. Each one of these categories has a set of demographics with it. And it has a number of dwelling units or density per acre. It has wastewater, water, vehicle trips per day, number of residents per dwelling unit, those types of demographics. So for each one, they're different depending on how they played out. Now, we started out with six land use categories, as Brian was saying. But we had to add some others, our TM strict mixed use. When we were building this base, like he said, this is based, we count the number of 911 addresses on each square, and we assign it a land use based on that. We look at the land cover to see if there's employment in there, and we might make it a mixed-use category then instead of just a residential. So we have our rural, which are these green. We have our T2 suburban, which is our AR1, which ends up at about 1.3, 1.4 units per acre with our building efficiencies and calculations. There is no mixed, there's no non-residential in there. We have some more dense areas here, and each of these that you're looking at here, this is the base. It's been calibrated to the United
That's
States.
That's currently point. What's happening.
This
is
right.
What's
it's on currently the on the ground, and I've calibrated it to the 2010 census. Okay. So it's based on, like, in Bridgeville, I think it's 2.89 people per household. So each one of these has its own category for those. So.
Hey, Carol, can you move right and pick some of the squares just to show
I'm
you?
I'm
going to
do that right now. I'm going to grow. I think they like the T4. This is a suburban mixed use. It's 4 units per acre, and it has about 150,000 square feet of non-residential. And I'm just going to paint this little area over here where I believe was kind of growth area. And that's now, I didn't
now
get
Now those
everything.
Algorithms were processing in the background. They're running the changes that were just made, and the analysis has changed. We can bring up the data set and see what impact.
We have to run build out. Okay, and then we were going to grow a little bit over here, I believe. So right now I'm changing the land use, and I'm creating a whole different scenario. And let's say we were up in Greenwood.
We're just moving those little tiles around.
Use up here all the way around. So we're going to grow around it. Okay, and we're going to grow in a mixed-use fashion, maybe more compact than it's used to. And I'm going to add a little town center in here because we're going to grow a little bit more in the center of town.
So you get the idea of what's happening, how easy it is to paint as compared to moving the tiles around on a piece
okay.
of paper, taping them on there. We also have the layers in the background. You want to see the ortho, the aerial, we can bring that up, okay? You want to see the 911 structures, we have that later. We can bring that up. So all those data sets are very helpful when people are having a conversation and trying to come to decisions.
Is this online?
We have a website. It's
like
the Cape and Local Regional
this
Plan.
Game
can't, no, not quite. Not quite.
Here you can see this is, I'm going to run build out or land use capacity now. I'm going to, here each one, you can see it's 0.04 density, 0.2, if we get to 8. And here are your others. These are your individual numbers. The density, I have whether they're mixed use or not. I'm able to state whether it's the percent residential, non-residential in my mixed use. This sets the land percentages. So for my T4, 80% of my land is going to be residential and 20 is going to be non-res, okay? And that increases as you go up in density. It took us about 3.5 years to define these densities. 2006 to 2008 or 9? And they're all based on Sussex County. They are real numbers based on Sussex County, not national numbers. Where we can set the building setbacks. Well, this constraint, we don't want to constrain it by Sussex County. We want to constrain it. We want to say it's the out of play. We're going to take out as non-buildable, okay? We can add any type of layers there that are possible. We can put in buildings that are already there, and then we can finish it. Run, build out. But I could save that as a new scenario. Say scenario one, town center growth.
So it just takes a couple minutes to process. What we typically do is have that turned off, and at the end we'll do what we're doing now is run building. Just we don't interfere with the conversation that's ongoing. But sometimes people want us to do it simultaneously. They want to see their changes.
Well, you want to see the effect of your
exactly
yeah, your incremental right. change. Yeah.
And I didn't notice any manufacturing theme or industrial theme in your layer.
In the base? Mm-hmm. Well, the purple represents employment centers, so that would capture some of the industrial areas. Bridgeville, when they wanted, they got together and they wanted to create, they used an ag theme, Marty. They wanted to enhance ag operations mm-hmm. and business in the area. So that was the theme of their business employment centers, that purple.
So here you can see what we had before we changed into these mixed-use categories where we added the growth to the areas around the towns. You can see here we went from less than 5 million square feet to over 8 million square feet of non-residential space. And also look at the dwelling units. You can see the change in the dwelling units. And this is comparing all the scenarios. Table 1 and Table 2 were the probably what you're looking at in there, mm-hmm. which was our stakeholders, our town council, our town administrators came together, they met, they painted these two, and then came together and painted a third.
Okay, gotcha.
Oh, this is going to be their master plan scenario. And Brian will explain where it goes from there.
And to really reiterate what Carol said, this is their scenario.
Your employees.
All we do is give them the opportunity to come together in a conversation, and we ask some questions to get them thinking.
That's
but at the end of the day, they're either telling us where to put that crayon, or they're actually putting the crayon down and doing it themselves.
Can I say that again?
That's what's very unique about this.
Yeah,
so, and as Carol elaborated and what I've handed out to you to give you a better idea of the samples, these are tables 1 and table 2 that were produced during the Bridgeville conversation. And then the last two pages show you the numbers that were there. And we actually compared the numbers against some of the same examples that I gave you in the PowerPoint presentation, where we had the economic development theme, we had the megagopolis, et cetera. So they're able to see just what their changes are.
This is table 2. This
are these changes or are these?
These are brand new scenarios that they made themselves.
And here's what they came up
from
with
the base
together.
Layer. And then they're
what's the base layer?
Where
the
you don't have a
base layer is the very beginning there.
Okay.
Okay. And then it goes all the way over to there.
I got it.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, this model, the purpose for the Chesapeake Bay program is to look at agriculture, land use, wastewater, et cetera. And one of the directives from EPA is for the TMDLs to be lowered based on land use. So Brian has combined that requirement plus the master planning process to come up with this. We have submitted our model to EPA in the last 2 years because we started out painting that entire corridor, the Chesapeake watershed, which goes all the way up through Kent and Newcastle. You saw that on that one picture. And that's the base for that. And then we were required to do 2015 and 2026. And they have reviewed our model, they've reviewed all the formula, and they have accepted it. They've approved it because they have their own land use model. And Denrec had a choice of using their own, which this has been approved for use.
That's an important point. This exercise is a component of the Chesapeake Watershed Implementation Plan. Okay, the state's required to do it. And we have an opportunity to use our model, okay, our data, which we think is certainly more palatable to you and to the public rather than having the EPA come in and use the data they have available. So this is Carol took painstaking efforts to make sure that the data sets that we're using have been ground truth. She went out and counted structures within each one of those 100-acre grids just to make sure that the densities are spot on accurate.
Was just a simple.
The actual subdivision, the industrial sites, not just the comp plan, but you have the actual usage that's already built out. Plus, so you have another layer with what's been permitted but maybe not built yet as another layer. You have, do you have electric utilities and identify the utilities, whether it's the Delaware Co-op or Delaware Power?
We can do that.
Yeah, those layers are available.
Yeah. Right, that hasn't been one of the requirements for this particular project. You can see here the structures, this is from your shop. You can see here how we painted each one of these. You can see the many, many, many 100 acres with nothing, one to two or three.
So those are dwelling units?
Those are dwelling units, and they have associated with them. And our data's not really great, but it tells us whether it's a residential or a multifamily slash commercial. So we have to also look at one other thing, because now this data set's being redone, I understand, and we will know whether it's residential or commercial non-residential, and then for the residential, we'll know if it's residential or multifamily. So that will give us a much more accurate picture, and we won't need to add to it.
But to go back to your question, Marty, it's the data sets that we are here is really based on the immediate scenario that we have. One of the things that we've talked about in other applications where we've presented this as an economic development scenario is, well, let's put those layers down. What does a Walmart need to come? Okay, that's our goal, is to have a Walmart. Well, they need sewer, they need water, they need electric, and we can then begin to single out locations or areas within that can do that just simply based on the layers. In our case, for this scenario, we had the lights. We can't flush the hoppers, so we focused in on the wastewater and looked at some of those applications there, knowing that the number of residential units that are considered ultimately drives the size of that plant, and then ultimately will determine the cost associated with it, and then we got to figure out how they're going to pay for it, because that's the real challenge, because they've got to take on debt structure, they've got to identify land, they've got to have a willing farmer that will take on the spray irrigation. So all these things begin to factor in, putting the rubber to the road.
Here you
future
see
development is in there, so lands that are approved for
yes.
development.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
If the lot is recorded, it is in there.
It's
and
in there.
Counted.
Mm-hmm. Remember, your 911 address structure gives us two things. One, what is an actual structure, so it's your home. The other it gives us is a recorded lot. It's a lot that has a potential for a 911 address. So we know right off the bat then that we've got something occurring there in that given area. So we then factor that in. As Carol said, our real challenge has been determining some of the commercial uses. That's where the aerial ortho comes in, where we try to break that down. And we know that Lawrence's shop is working to revise some of its practices and some of its things, and we're hoping that that becomes part of the key.
The structures file has been fantastic, don't get me wrong, but you know, we need to have them defined as residential and commercial so that we can be more accurate on that. We have a ground cover, a land cover that tells us where the commercial is. We also ground truth it by going in here because there are structures that aren't built, are recorded but not built. We are counting those, but there are also buildings there, houses that don't have address structures yet. So we've gone in and we've looked for those also. So we're trying to be as accurate as we can. And we think when I compare it to the census, I'm within 95% of the census numbers. So that's what we're working from. And we redid the calibration based on the 2010 census. So we're feeling really good about the numbers and our abilities with that.
I think you can see that the land use model is an incredibly powerful tool for us to use. But the weed table we're also finding is a powerful tool.
Wonderful.
We've been tapped by the Center for the Inland Base to come down in a week and a half and work with the committee there that is trying to identify areas in the bays that are suitable for commercial shellfish aquaculture. So we're actually going to have the commercial clammers in the room around the table looking at some of the overlays that they produced based on a clam survey they did. So we're looking at clam densities. We're trying to keep out of areas that might impact their commercial operations. So it's just a, it's a wonderful tool to engage people in decision making.
When you have your bait, was there any way to pull in Delta future plans for alignments?
True, because this, these are spatial overlays, and we take our squares and we say, okay, select the ones that have, give me an example of the, so select the one that has a Del Dot plan, and then we can assign it whatever we need to for that.
Well, the big issue in the Bristol area has been the 404, whether or not it should be dualized, and then you're going to get a major impact to change the Bristol if they're at.
We are working on the next version. I'm testing it. I have to integrate it. What it will do will automatically build toward a town center, the growth district town center, ESDA, or developing areas. It will automatically, if we tell it to, grow towards a new road. All we have to do is tell it to, tell it which of those layers. It will grow away from something if we want it to. So.
So it's an ag easement. It will also, this is built out scenario. We also are working on the version 2 function that will allow us to forecast growth at time periods, intervals, you know, 2 years, 5 years, 20 years, 30 years.
And that's also, again, that will be based on real numbers. For your benefit, for about the past 6 years now, 5 years, we've been collecting data from the local jurisdictions about building permits, zoning changes. Those things have formulated into then absorption rates, and those absorption rates then will go in. So I always use the example of the little town of Bethel, if in fact Bethel were to grow. Well, right now their absorption rate is one house per year, and they've built 6 homes over the past 6 years. So if they propose 100 lots, it kind of gives you the idea of what to expect. We use that same principle here in this jurisdiction. We have that based again on information that they've given us. So we're able then to forecast out that situation.
And as you can see, we can do what if scenarios. We can change the, what we like to keep our standards set, but let's say we had an efficiency. Now this, when Brian was talking about roads and setbacks and things like that, we can go into the next stage that the software lets us do. We can actually put buildings on the ground. And you saw on the presentation, you can also get, we have 3D representations on Google Earth. So you actually get a visualization of density. But here we have the T2 suburban or our AR1. And it requires, 15 to 25% open space? So this is where we're allowed, we only allow 70% growth there. At this very high level of planning, we don't want to say there's a sidewalk along this. We don't want to say there are driveways. So we're allocating only 70% build efficiency. And we can change those as we need to. And like we said also, some of the jurisdictions have required a higher density than we have. So we, in Georgetown, their comp plan calls for 16 units per acre with only 50,000 square feet of mixed use. So we were able to, we just created a new use, a new land use type for that, and we can go with that then for per jurisdiction.
So
very flexible.
So if you're wondering about cost for a setup like this, most people have a laptop, most organizations or agencies have a projector, so it's probably, well, including the table, $350, and that includes the tarp there and the mobility it offers. The only drawback I can think of the thing is if we have a thunderstorm and power goes out, then the old maps and tiles are probably a better option for us.
Well, you need and a licensed copy of ARCView, too.
Licensed copy of ARCView, yeah. Yeah.
And community biz runs about $300 and some per year.
That's not expensive.
Yeah, Smoothboard, the smart board technology is $30 for an online license.
You spend $300 a year for the software, access to the software.
There's a license, the annual license. But we start to weigh that against the time for 4 of us to sit down and cut out 900 little tiles and make maps.
Well, even, you know.
And then the scale changes every time you move to a new municipality, so you gotta do it again.
They use post-its and charrettes, right? This is a little more sophisticated than that. But our jurisdictions, particularly these two, have been absolutely fantastic. They learned it within half an hour, and they were painting by themselves. They did table one and two, and then came together. And because they were all talking, we did the paint as they went, but they directed us what they wanted changed. So that this is their, now this is the version right now. Now, Brian, tell them where this goes. I think that's important.
Well, where we are at this point is we reached consensus. We took the two working groups and combined them into one version that they've agreed on.
And this now, is Bridgeville and Greenwood.
Bridgeville and Greenwood. So, but this process is relatively the same regardless of where we are in the jurisdictions. In this case now, that map, because many of the agencies now look to parcels for general information and some of their internal work is done based on the parcel level, we'll take the 100 acres and we will convert it to a parcel level map. And then that map then goes through the process of going through the different agencies to engage, okay, what's DLDOT doing here, what's Ag doing, what is DENREC doing, and we normally use the plus process for that. But at the same time, we're taking this 100-acre square map, and we're beginning to engage the local public at large to get feedback. So we'll now be meeting with the ag community, we'll be meeting with the business communities, we'll meet with the residents again. We joke that if necessary, we're gonna set up a table at Jeff's Tap Room so we can get feedback, and the wagon wheel in Greenwood so we can get feedback. The goal is
Jimmy's Grill isn't opening on Friday mornings now.
Yeah. So you know, so we've got
Friday mornings with Brian.
That's right.
Planning with Brian.
So but what we're doing there is we're truthing this even further. The stakeholders have given us a general vision. Now we want to hear from the public if that's palatable to them. We'll then tweak this image that you see here, meaning that we know there's going to be some things that the agencies are going to come back with. Hopefully, you know, DLDOT will tell us that, yes, in fact, we are going to do something to the bypass, so that's going to change possibly what the community wants to do there for industry. Locals will hopefully come back and say, you know what, we really don't like that idea. What can we do to soften that? They bring that back then to the stakeholders. We review all of that, and we come to one final consensus, and then that map becomes then the driving element behind the master plan, and in this case is the driving element to build a phasing plan for their wastewater plant so we can begin to start addressing infrastructure needs. And that's the steps, and that's how we do this every time.
In Southeast neighborhood in Milford, we got to the composite, the state agencies reviewed it and said what really should be done, what should be protected, and there were some trade-offs there with the medical and professional center. We were able to do at 2% growth rate, which was Milford's growth rate that they gave us. We did 10 years and 20 years out. We prepared scenarios for each of those. And then they spatially were able to overlay this on the parcels. They were able to identify parcels. They actually talked to the people who would be interested in receiving density, who would be interested in transferring density. They even identified their TDR zones by parcel, and then we brought that back into this map, which became their final. So you're able to transfer it up and down by scale.
So Milford's all finished.
That's Southeast neighborhood, okay. Right?
Yeah. And they're what they're looking at now, the plan itself is finished. They're actually implementing. Where they are now is they're pricing out how to get water to the site. And they've gone through a design there to actually be responsible for constructing a water tower and the pipes to the site to make it viable. And they've already engaged Hans at Kent County to begin the process of building sewer out to that location. DLDOT has already started making some improvements. You've already seen the 30-in-1 interchange close. And we've already moved the homes around that intersection. That project is in this year's CTP, and they should be going out to bid, knock on fake wood, and if they're doing it responsibly, in October, with the idea that it would start construction sometime over the winter or early spring of next year. So when these are in place, things really begin to happen. From our perspective, for these two communities, again,
put the bay aside with the plant that it's in the condition that it's in now. This was essential for us to be able to sit down with USDA, with the folks at Denrec, Terry Deputy's shop, and the loan and the water revolving fund folks, to be able to start formulating a package that both communities could either, one, continue working in the partnership that they have, two, create two separate plants, one for Greenwood and one for Bridgeville, or the third option in the plan is a hybrid scenario where there's either a public-private partnership beyond the two towns, which may involve then engaging Mike Izzo and the county, or may be involved then engaging one of the local utilities, whether it's an Artesian or Tidewater, to see how we can begin to address the issue. Because, again, it's a plant that needs a little bit of love. And unfortunately, the communities right now, with the costs associated with it, just can't afford to give it all the love it needs to keep it going. So this is the master planning process. This is the technology. This is the model, the video game concept, which is the Wii table. And this is our dog and pony show.
I'm just curious the timing, just with, because I've had a little bit of familiarity with Bridgeville and Greenland, their wastewater plant. If, you know, to develop that and go through a meeting like this, you know, where you actually try to decide to build out and then take it back to the state agencies and then bring it back, you know, meanwhile they've got a failing plant. Just what kind of time frame is that? Or I'm thinking even for the county, if the county had a, you know, a big project like we haven't seen in a while and we wanted to get information on how that affects, you know, that particular area of the county, sort of what's the time frame for going through the exercise? Just out of curiosity.
For our process here, we started in November of last year. Started talking about it in November and getting buy-in and ownership in that both jurisdictions were willing to do this. We actually started the process in February, and we're now at this point here in July. Truth be told, we probably could have tightened that up a little bit.
I understand. It's probably one of the first ones that you've gone through, too. Yeah.
We probably could have, but we wanted to be respectful. And I'll be honest, there's a real personal dynamic here, and this is not... We probably could have started with an easier one. We could have done Delmar. But we started here, and so some of that time not only was dedicated to this, Vince, but was also dedicated to building trust.
Yeah, no, I can imagine that.
Sharing
in this case.
Pizza.
Yeah.
I mean, getting them talking.
Yeah.
I mean, it involved a lot of chicken groups and pizza to get them to want to come and actually agree.
The county wasn't part of that? I mean, with those two towns, they work together, but there's still space of county. It's not all municipality land.
Now, what we've been doing here in the past is working with Lawrence from the perspective of, you know, constantly keeping Shane and Lawrence in the loop. And when we reach a point where we come to the agencies, and this is how I've been interacting with the county, is I really need you now. You know, because some of the personal dynamics and some of the pizza sharing, you know, I can be respectful. You may not want to be there to see the horse trading or the bloodletting. And in some of the cases, we just wanted them to do it themselves. But
already had an agreement in place too. I mean, that's so there was looking at different ways to amend their existing agreement. There's all kinds of dynamics that are pretty unique to this one.
So where we are with this, Marty, is we're constantly talking to these guys. And when I say these guys, I mean your staff here in the building, whether it's Todd, whether it's Lawrence. Before we gave this demonstration today, we talked about the need. We've got to sit down with Mike Izzo, because one of the last areas that we will be doing will be Seaford and Blades. And there's already a county sewer district in place there. But the question is based on where the failing systems are with the information that we have.
But in both those cases, Seaford and Blades and Bridgeville Greenwood, mm-hmm. I mean, there's industrial manufacturing areas outside of the municipality, the corporate mm-hmm. limits, that it would benefit everybody have sewer and water there mm-hmm. for the manufacturing industrial jobs, even though they're in county land versus the municipality. And why couldn't you partner between our county engineering and the municipalities to help share that cost of the sewer expense?
Well, I don't disagree with you. It's an excellent opportunity.
I can tell you that we began that conversation in 03 or 04, and I can tell you the personal dynamic then. I'm going to leave out a lot of the colorful metaphors Mike used, but he said, no way are we going there anytime soon. and that was part of the challenge.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. However, what you have here is a very powerful tool to help people visualize, mm-hmm. to help them see. For instance, I mean, or you take your show on the road, because I know that that Laurel, and this is really more through the Chamber of Commerce, we've partnered with the town, and we've set up an economic development committee, if you will, with the long-range view of trying to get an industrial park somewhere, mm-hmm. somewhere around Laurel. Well, this would be, part and parcel of that whole, it would be part and parcel of your whole process here. I know people don't know about this.
Well, you'd be surprised. We've been to SCAT, and I will tell you that word of mouth has probably been the best way that this has been getting around right now, because the 13 string of pearls of Sussex County are aware of this and are wanting us to come do this very type of planning. To bring back full circle about what I said before, the concept now and the working arrangement with Mike is if you come with me with something like this and you've done the bloodletting, now I'm ready to come back to the table and engage. So we've worked through the personalities, and now we're back to that point where we can start having good conversation about, can we create that kind of partnership again? So, and I can respect anyone in that circumstance where, you can't save them all. And, they've got to want to save themselves. We're now at that point, and they're beginning to work through it. But this is a great way to visualize it.
I believe Lawrence participated in the Georgetown master plan process. I think he painted the whole damn map green golf courses, right?
Yeah. The first time I saw it was probably 3 years ago, Carol, at the Garville Center, where we were looking at the whole,
entire county.
Yeah, the entire county. And that was kind of scary, but we had tile network. And then the last time was working somewhat with the Georgetown, and then I saw it at a SCAT meeting a couple months back at Richmond Bethany, where you did that presentation down there.
Well, being able to do the situational analysis on the fly is just priceless. And I think this is going to be an important tool for everybody, and it'll help people visualize what the impact of what they're thinking is. And it's exciting. How do you guys do this? Would you come if somebody invited you to demonstrate your mm-hmm. thing?
Yeah,
that's what we've been doing.
That's what we've been doing. We just
is there a particular type of venue you would need? Do it for a Chamber of Commerce or something like that?
We'll take it on the roof. Yeah, we are.
Right now, we're open to everyone and anyone.
Okay.
We just, you might want to share a little bit with about the Cape region. Mm-hmm. And just real quick, one of the reasons you've heard us talk about scenarios, and scenarios are basically stories. And what we do is we'll put together kind of a key group or a steering committee to build a couple scenarios, let things that could or may not happen. And that's basically just to start a conversation. Do I like a new town concept? Do I like an economic development? Give me the jobs piece. But the object of the game is, throw the scenarios out. They're a starting point. You might like one a little bit, but let's work on it. So with the Cape, which is basically 400 grids, it's kind of more of a self-engaged, let's see what we want type piece, because nobody mandated planning in that region anyhow. But you all know it's ground zero. That's where the growth was going. It's your economic development zone. So what they're doing is, we started with scenarios. We did one workshop that pretty much explained it. So now they can hop on the web. They can take a survey. They can say, I like scenario 1, 2, 3. I don't like any of them. They can build their own. But what we then did was extend the offer to any community group that wants to engage. So right now we'll be doing the Weed Table with the League of Women Voters. Hopefully with the Sussex County Association of Realtors.
Villages of 5 Points.
Villages of 5 Points. So that's kind of more of an extension, and every time you go out, we learn, everybody else learns, and we continue to crank this thing up.
So just visiting the website for that project, it's www.capehenlopenregionalplan.org. It's a pretty comprehensive website. You talk about visualization. We've actually taken it one level higher by applying a 3D structure view to the covers that you see here, so people can actually see. And you saw them up there, the form-based tiles. You saw the density there represented graphically. So we have a flyover on the website, so you can begin to see how that the colors manifest as structures on the landscape.
The goal is it to create a baseline scenario. For instance, you want to know what Secret Blades, for instance, is today. Somebody has to put that together, right?
It's already done.
It's already done.
The county is the baseline is together. So now everybody. We get the entire county.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. The entire county, and then the Chesapeake Bay portions of Kent and Newcastle. So roughly a third of Kent is completed, and then only about an eighth of Newcastle is completed. But in your case,
we actually extract this from the base, the county base, and then we revalidate it against the census. So there are areas of the county that we still need to check with the 2010 census, but almost all of that is, that's just a matter of doing it as we go.
Can you email us
a link to the
county? What I'm, this is another conversation, I guess. What I'm thinking is that the town of Laurel and the Chamber of Commerce have partnered up on some other things, and this would be a good thing for us to jointly sponsor, to let people come realize what's available, and then see if we can get the town engaged in
the
process.
The
maybe
town,
you've already done that. Maybe you've already.
Well, no, what we have been doing, because again, this is we mentioned earlier on, we're doing this for all of the larger communities as well as the small jurisdictions, mm-hmm. but slightly differently for mm-hmm. everyone in the watershed. We started here because this was kind of ground zero. Mm-hmm. We've agreed that we want to either do Laurel or Del Mar next. Because the last one, obviously, being Seaford and Blades, we know that's going to be a little bit of work. Because in that scenario, again, going back to having that conversation, currently our district for the sewer goes south on River Road down to Woodland Ferry. But when you put where the failing systems are and where the challenges are, it's actually on the other side of Seaford going out to Middleford, Sand Hill, and Concord Pond. So, you know, we're going to have a real conversation of how this county may be asked to invest over time, as well as what those two local jurisdictions are going to be contributing.
Marty was just referring to the notion that we have to the county and the municipalities have to partner up on this stuff,
mm-hmm. right.
And that's really what this speaks to. That's really what I'm talking about is mm-hmm. in the Laurel area, because you're talking about an area that's going to go much past what the town limits are. It's everybody. So.
And it spreads the cost, and there's already uses there. I mean, in Bridgeville's case, you've got O.A. Newton Purdue's and all that. Mm-hmm. In Laurel's case, you've got the other side with Genosics and the flea market and the Sussex Machine and Sussex Irrigation and all that. I mean, so that stuff's already there, whether we are going to take advantage of that and expand on what is already, you know, or make a new footprint someplace else, which probably
might be a lot. I'm thinking about it, too, that it probably works better in those situations. I'm just curious, because this doesn't take into account really any jurisdictional lines in the Cape region. I'm just trying to think how, you know, say you've got Lewis and Rehoboth and their comp plans and their zoning, which is really different from the county, and you know, and if you got a group of folks that was in one of those jurisdictions, they're going to have a real different idea of planning outside of their jurisdiction than we do. I'm curious how that dynamic plays into all.
Well, when
that.
We do that, we've not only done the
because it works
for
probably
the
in the Laurel
county.
Area better than
it's easier.
Easier, yeah.
But it's already done in Rehoboth. We already have a county city sewer.
Yeah, no, I'm talking about more about land use though.
Well,
I mean,
when we extract the base, we also paint the comp plan, and it's based on the county comp plan and the individual jurisdictions. Now, this one is probably not exactly.
Right. But does it take into account, like, the future annexation areas for the towns? Okay, it does. Because there's an overlap there with the county and the towns.
And where you get to that's why we talk about density,
right.
is we try to bridge that. Because when you just said, you know, the zoning in this side of the line is going to be different than this one. We talk about density because at the end of the day, everyone can appreciate 4 units to the acre, 8 units to the acre.
And so they're able to grasp that, and we move away from the jurisdictional piece.
And you're inevitably going to get into the dynamics and the give and take of what are you going to, are you going to change your zoning to conform with your plan, or are you going to change your plan to conform with your zoning?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure that the both of those things are going to happen at different times, I suspect.
And you got landowner, you know, either cooperation or objection, you know.
Sure.
Just because we put a dot on there and later,
right.
I'm not selling.
Yeah, right.
No,
that doesn't mean they want to be that.
Yeah,
now.
And that's right.
That's,
you know,
right.
And that's right.
That's
Rolls Royce, and I'm not letting, you know.
That's
first,
right. That's
one of
the
first set
part
of questions we ask, mm-hmm, is,
yeah,
what's most important to the participants? And we want it right up front. And if private property rights is up, that's fine. Because you can paint the prettiest picture in the world, but on the back end, you still got to go through all the stuff that hit it in the front side. You know, property values, all that kind of stuff, we want it right up front. So you can paint away. And literally, at the end of the day, if that's what you want, then let's go back to step one, because you're going to have to work through every one of those issues to get through. And it is. It's trade-offs. I mean, and you know, Laurel, we all know, you know, it is. It's the idea that if I do want this to stay a green area, right now, sorry, there's some real equity out there. Now, what are you going to do with it? How do you do it? So it drives you into having these conversations about moving equity, you know, whatever, however you do that.
Right.
And that's right up front. First thing, that first quiz that we give anybody in these regional plans is, what's of value to you? What's important? And what are, and, you know, and so, and that's the disclaimer.
Because it seems like the tool that's good for this with regional planning is it makes folks think about and realize,
mm-hmm,
okay, this is what we wish for, but this is what really is the way things
well,
are developing.
And,
you know?
Well, and
it sounds like that's the discussion that you were
right
saying.
And then I'll use the for the next step going out the piece. You know, the stakeholder group was very adamant. They wanted to be an economic development type situation, and they wanted to be agricultural based. Well, we were very clear. Well, we can do that, but now we got to make certain that this is what you've described. Now we're going out and talking to farmers. So we're going to the T.D. Smiths. We're going to go see the Vanderwinds. We're going to go see the Adamses, et cetera. What's your plans for this? And because, you know, I could walk on the Adams farm and say, well, we're going to make this an employment center, and I could get run out on a rail.
Now, who actually does this visiting and talking to these folks?
We will. What we've done is, this one will be, it's usually we bring representatives from both jurisdictions.
Mm-hmm.
Someone like myself, Ed or Carol, or someone may be on board as well, and we go out and we will either have a, and we, yeah, for Denrec, we have Jim Walls. But we, you know, we'll invite them in. You know, if you can entice them in with punch and pie to bring them to us.
Or pizza.
Yeah.
Or all the above.
All the above. Or
but once without.
Or we go door to door.
But you know, Brian, that's always a temporary. 6 years ago, 7 years ago, the ag return was abysmal, and every other use was fantastic.
Right.
Okay.
Now it's the other way around.
Six or seven years later, when the ag bit me, today corn is over $8, and I hope it doesn't stay there because it's not healthy for anybody, but that's a different issue. I mean, today the ag is competing head-to-head and actually beyond some of the other uses because that's flipped. And so if you went in that guy's living room or whatever 7 years ago, you would have gotten one answer. You go in there today, and you're going to get another answer yet, but we're trying to plan 10, 15, 20,
well,
30 years down.
I think this is an excellent time to be doing this, though. When
things are equitable.
Well,
yeah, some,
yeah, when it's not so, when there's not all this development pressure,
yeah,
you know, and I'm, you know, it's just something we need to, we have time to do it.
Well, in the Cape region, let me ask you a question. Was there pushback on density?
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at, because it was the reverse of what you just said. It was where every comp plan and infrastructure and spreading costs around says you need to push density.
I mean,
there's
a lot of games we can play if some high density is acceptable. I'm not saying across the whole planning district, but if some high density, I'm talking, you know, just basically no limit. If you meet, we'll let you build almost whatever the market will accept. As long as you, as we'll put some restrictions, it's not on a broad base. But I mean, the public have to accept that.
Well, that's
what 13-story building, 10-story building.
And that's what the concept, one of the samples that we give, or one of the scenarios, is what's called a node scenario. And for that node to work, for you to have the bus stop, for you to have the bike pass, for you to have to get from point A to point B, you're going to have to give me some trade-off. And that trade-off means real density.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'll give you a real example. When we've run some scenarios on what the they say are better projects, superior projects, Village of Five Points, So it has that downtown area and all that. At the end of the day, it's still only 3.48 units to the acre. Yeah.
And mass transit doesn't function.
And so, yeah, so I need at least, I need at least 6.5 or better to justify the DART being on a continuous loop, not just the right. seasonal stop or the on-call stop.
Right.
So, you know, so these are the things that, you have to have that conversation about.
And that all factors into the discussion.
We have a time constraint. Mm-hmm. So there's another group coming in at 6. These guys need a chance to pack up, and the other people need a chance to come in. But what I would like to do is adjourn the meeting if not more than two commissioners want to hang around and have a little more conversation informally with these guys. We certainly can do it, but thank you very much for coming. Maybe I was the last person in the world to find out, but I had heard about it, but this is the first time I've seen it.
Thank you, IG.
Yes, and it was Mr. Burton who brought it to the commission's attention.
I got to go to the Lewis one.
Okay. Yeah, and that is
anything
on the website.
For,
for everyone's benefit, I do have copies of the PowerPoint if you'd like to have one. Any questions? I'll make PDF and send it to you.
Cool.
All right. Anybody else have anything for the good of the orders? I would like to adjourn the meeting. You can continue informally as long as there's not one or two commissioners. I think. Okay. We stand adjourned. Peace and harmony prevail.
Turn your system over here.
Future watch this guy.
5:17. See you, Marty. Good luck with the chickens.
Those colors on there at the end, the pinks and the yellows, those match as close as we can with squares to the comp plan developing.
Because I was trying to think of.
Yeah, and we overlay that, and they can look at it and they can see that, and those are the annexation areas for Georgetown.